Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a truly fascinating paradox of history. You know how we often think of nations as, well, unified communities and empires as these sprawling, multi-ethnic conquests?
Right, they seem like completely opposite ideas.
Exactly. Yeah. But what if, in some cases, they were actually two sides of the very same coin?
That's precisely what we'll explore today. We're heading to Tsarist Russia, specifically the period between 1884 and 1914.
Okay.
And we're going to look at how it transformed its Far East, which was essentially a distant, pretty vulnerable imperial periphery, into something much more like integrated national territory.
Interesting. So not just conquering, but making it Russian.
Precisely. It's a remarkable example of what scholars call nationalizing empire, this idea where nation building and imperial expansion became deeply, maybe surprisingly, entangled.
Our journey today is inspired by some really compelling work from a talented young scholar, Paul Osterbury. His essay for Oxford's St. Hugh's College sheds incredible light on this, well, quite intricate period.
And there's a fascinating personal connection too, isn't there?
Yeah, it really brings it home. Paul's own great-great-grandfather, Nikolai Osterbury, was actually a captain and photographer deployed out there in Manchuria.
Wow.
Yeah, with the 17th Chernigov Hussars Regiment during that pivotal Russo-Japanese War, it just underscores, you know, how deeply human these big historical narratives really are.
Absolutely. So to really get this transformation, we need to step back a bit. How did Russia even get this huge territory in the first place?
Right, it wasn't always theirs.
No, it came from a, let's say, weakened King China through treaties, the Treaty of Agun in 1858. And then Beijing in 1860.
And the main goal?
The primary motivation seems pretty clear. Securing access to those crucial warm water ports. They needed them for a future Pacific fleet.
So this wasn't just some random land grab. It was very strategic thinking, especially after the Crimean War, right?
Exactly. There was a real concern that rivals, like the British or maybe the Americans, might just sweep in and take it.
Ah.
So General Nikolai Muraev, he took the initiative to sort of preemptively claim this region. It was often seen as terra nullius, empty land.
Empty land, ripe for settlement.
Pretty much. Ripe for Russian settlement, anyway. It started as a defensive move, really, but it laid the groundwork for this profound process of, well, national integration later on.
Interesting how that happens.
It is. And the period we're zeroing in on, from 1884, that really kicks off with the establishment of the Primer General Governorship.
Okay, so that's the formal starting point for this push.
That's the moment, yeah. It marked the beginning of Russia's really concerted effort to make this distant land truly its own.
So the central argument here, the thread running through our whole discussion today, is this idea that nation building and empire, they weren't working against each other.
Not in this case, no. They were profoundly interlinked. We usually think of an empire as, you know, a large composite, multi-ethnic or multinational political unit, often built through conquest.
Right. And a nation more like a community of kinship, maybe a shared identity, self-consciousness.
But here's the twist. What we see in the Russian Far East is nation-building imperialism in action.
Nation-building imperialism. Explain that a bit more.
It's where nationalists, or at least the state, acting with nationalist aims, actively work towards cultural homogenization across the entire state. Mm-hmm. Even within that huge imperial framework.
So trying to make the empire feel more like a single nation?
Essentially, yes. It's about transforming a diverse empire into something more cohesive, something that feels national, right from the core out to its farthest edges, like the Far East.
And how did Tsarist Russia actually try to do this? It's a massive task.
Well, the Eskali has three really fascinating interconnected methods. First, massive peasant resettlement.
Getting people out there.
Exactly. Second, building game-changing railway infrastructure.
Connecting it all up.
Uh-huh. And third, putting in place specific anti-foreigner laws, particularly those dealing with what was controversially known back then as the yellow question.
Okay, let's dig into that first one. The people. The peasant resettlement. That sounds like the human engine driving this whole thing. How did Russia's geography, being this huge land-based empire, affect that?
Well, it gave them a unique advantage, really. Unlike, say, the British or French with overseas colonies, Russia didn't have that clear, sharp distinction between the national core and the periphery. It all just sort of flowed together on the map.
Right. No oceans in the way.
Exactly. And this geographical reality allowed for what was, frankly, one of history's most ambitious and in many ways successful settler colonial projects.
Settler colonialism within its own contiguous territory.
Precisely. and Russian peasants had already been moving east and south for centuries, often illegally, trying to escape serfdom, poverty, just looking for land. They were pushing into these imperial frontiers.
But settling the Far East specifically, that was tough going at first, wasn't it? Why was that?
Yeah, it was a slow start. For one, there wasn't much state support early on. Why? Because resettlement was seen as, well, draining cheap labor away from landowners back in European Russia.
Ah, the economic interests back home.
Definitely. Plus, Siberia had this really grim reputation. The explorer Fridtjof Nansen called it a convict colony. It wasn't exactly appealing for free migrants, you know.
So General Muravyev's big vision, the Amur region becoming a new Mississippi, filled with free Russian peasants. That didn't quite happen initially?
No, not really. Russia was also pretty focused on Central Asia at the time. So by 1883, the Russian population out in the Far East was still tiny, maybe only 79,000 people, mostly Cossacks and soldiers.
Wow, in that vast space.
Yeah. But then came a really crucial turning point, the establishment of the Resettlement Administration in 1896.
Okay, so the state steps in properly.
It signals the state is now actively willing to support and organize peasant migration. And this wasn't just about helping poor peasants. It was deeply strategic.
What was the strategic driver, man?
Growing worry. Russia started getting really concerned about its demographic vulnerability way out east.
Vulnerability? How so?
Well, you had this increasing presence of Han Chinese settlers just across the border in Manchuria, and quite a lot of Chinese seasonal workers already inside the Russian Far East.
Ah, the neighbors.
Exactly. Figures like A.V. Krivoshein, who later became Minister of Agriculture, argued very strongly that ethnic colonization, settling Russians there, was absolutely vital for the national interest.
So it's about securing the land by filling it with your own people.
That's the core idea. It wasn't just about drawing lines on a map anymore. It was about populating it.
So here's where that entanglement you mentioned gets really interesting. These peasants, they weren't necessarily hardcore nationalists heading out to build an empire for the Tsar, were they?
Probably not consciously, no. Mostly they were fleeing hardship, looking for land, trying to build a better life for themselves and their families. That was the primary motivation. But through their very movement, their sheer presence, they became these sort of unwitting instruments for what was termed cultural and ethnographic occupation.
Cultural occupation.
Yeah. There's a quote from a Moscow historian, Fyodor Mikhailovich Umanets, that really captures it. He said, "Russian plow and harrow must necessarily follow banners."
Wow. So their farming tools were as important as flags for claiming the land.
In effect, yes.
Hmm.
Their search for a better life ended up serving both settler colonialism and the state's nation-building goals at the same time.
It's quite a complex picture.
It really is. And this peasant resettlement directly fueled Russification. Remember, Russia's sovereignty claims in the Far East were relatively recent, maybe seen as a bit dubious internationally.
Right, it wasn't ancient Russian land.
No. So settling ethnic Russians there was seen as the most effective long-term way to solidify control. A scholar named Anatoly A. Remnev called this internal imperialism.
Internal imperialism.
Yeah, the idea of directing migration flows within the empire to solidify the Russian element and integrate these peripheries. Mm-hmm. It directly linked forming the imperial nation with physically expanding the national territory.
So a peasant family moving east wasn't just finding a new farm. They were, in a way, extending the Russian nation itself, embedding it within the empire's borders.
That's a great way to put it. It wasn't just about controlling land. It was about making it feel and be undeniably Russian.
Okay, so you've got the people moving out there. But how do you physically connect such a vast, newly settled territory back to the heartland, thousands of miles away?
Ah, well, for Tsarist Russia, the answer was literally iron and steel.
Yeah.
Railways. This brings us to the second key method of transformation.
The Trans-Siberian Railway.
Exactly. And from the very beginning, Russian railway projects weren't just about economics. They were driven much more by grand political and strategic goals.
Even back in the early days.
Oh, yeah. As early as 1835, you had Franz Anton von Gerstner advocating for railways, calling them an iron and a golden chain, binding together the parts of the truly immense empire.
An iron and golden chain. That's quite an image.
Isn't it? And decades later, 1883, the influential journalist Mikhail Katkov stressed that railways would consummate national cohesion.
Consummate national cohesion. So they saw it explicitly as a nation-building tool.
Absolutely. The Trans-Siberian, and that includes its later branches at the Amur and the Chinese Eastern Lines, they were explicitly designed as instruments of imperial rule. They were meant to consolidate the empire's space and, crucially for our discussion, facilitate that nation-building imperialism.
What was the main trigger for Tsar Alexander III to finally say, okay, let's build this colossal thing?
Fear, mostly. A profound sense of vulnerability. Siberia and the Far East just seemed dangerously underpopulated and underdeveloped.
You mentioned the small numbers earlier.
Yeah, I mean, by 1888, the entire Amur province had only about 61,000 Russian residents. It felt exposed.
And this fear was amplified by that yellow peril idea you mentioned.
Definitely. That discourse was pervasive at the time. K.N. Passiette, writing in 1874, starkly contrasted Russia's vast semi-desert borderlands with what he saw as China and Japan's million-strong compact population.
So fear of being overwhelmed demographically.
Precisely. That anxiety fueled the willingness on the Tsar's part to bear what everyone knew would be an immense economic burden to build these strategic railways. National security trumped cost.
Must have been an unbelievable undertaking.
Monumental. And Sergei Witte, the finance minister in 1892, he wasn't just thinking about moving troops or goods. He had this vision for the Trans-Siberian as a way to actually merge the Far East with the Russian heartland.
Merge them. Culturally, too.
Yes. He thought it would make the region more acquainted with Russian life. Maybe even, in his words, bring Christian love and enlightenment into dark Asia. A bit paternalistic, perhaps, but...
But clearly showing that blend of imperial control and national cultural mission.
Exactly. It was a vehicle for both physical and cultural integration, tying the empire together with this overarching vision of national purpose.
And did it work? Did the railway actually bring the people?
Oh, absolutely. After 1893, when parts of it started opening up, peasant migration just surged. Remember those numbers. From 81,000 Russians in 1888...
Dude.
To a staggering 875,000 by 1914, a tenfold increase.
Wow. That's transformation.
It really is. And it wasn't just about moving bodies. The Siberian Railroad Administration was very deliberate about building schools and churches all along the railway lines.
Ah, the cultural infrastructure to go with the physical tracks.
You got it. This was absolutely crucial for ensuring national cohesion. They didn't want these settlers becoming detached, culturally or politically, from the core.
So instill the right values.
Instill the values of faith, Tsar, and fatherland in these new territories. It was literally extending the Russian nation village by village along those iron rails.
It seems there was a huge symbolic aspect to this as well.
Definitely. Imperial authorities consciously, deliberately avoided calling the Far East a colony, even just administratively.
Why?
To prevent any separatist feelings from developing. Mm-hmm. They wanted it seen as integral Russia, not some disposable overseas possession.
And this ties into how geographers were thinking, too.
Yes, absolutely. You had influential figures like Pyotr Semenov-Tianchansky envisioning this single, unified cultural economic entity that he called Russian Eurasia.
Russian Eurasia. Not European Russia and Asian Russia, but one thing.
One thing. A vast, unified space stretching from the Arctic all the way to the Pacific.
Mm.
And crucially, it was to be seen not as some distant borderland, but as native and fully equal Russian land.
That's a powerful reframing.
It really is. And it allowed the whole process of colonization, of settlement, to be presented as something completely natural and organic, fundamentally different from, say, British or French maritime colonization.
Making Siberia in the Far East part of the homeland and fatherland, not just an imperial asset.
Exactly. So the railways were so much more than just transport. They were the physical lines drawing the Far East into the very definition of Russia itself. Mm-hmm. They were modern tools for unifying remote peripheries, stitching distant geography into this all-encompassing national imperial space.
This integration, though, bringing the core and periphery closer, must have also brought existing tensions to the surface, right? Especially around ethnicity in different groups.
Absolutely. That physical and symbolic integration inevitably highlighted complex racial dynamics and, frankly, conflicting interests. This is where we get into that difficult area referred to historically as the yellow question.
And the event that really seemed to crystallize things was the Russo-Japanese War, 1904-05.
Yes, that war was absolutely pivotal. Losing to Japan was a huge shock to the system. It forced Russia to kind of abandon what one scholar called conquistador imperialism, that relentless outward expansion.
So shift to defense and consolidation.
Exactly. The nationalizing empire now had to focus more on holding and integrating what it had, defining its borders more clearly, especially in the east.
Now, before the war, there was the Chinese Eastern Railway, the CER. What was its role?
Well, originally, Sergei Witte envisioned the CER as a tool for penetration pacifique, peaceful penetration into Manchuria. It was pretty overtly imperialistic and financially exploitative in its aims towards China.
But this didn't sit well with everyone back in Russia.
No, it actually clashed quite significantly with emerging Russian nationalist interests. You had figures like Spiridon Merkulov complaining that the CER's focus on Manchuria was hurting Vladivostok's economy.
Ah, internal Russian rivalries.
Yes. And Dean Subotic argued for prioritizing the Russian port of Vladivostok over the Manchurian port of Dalny, which Russia controlled at the time. It really highlights the contradictions within a nationalizing empire. Different imperial goals and national sentiments were often pulling in different directions.
Fascinating. So the empire wasn't always a unified actor.
Far from it. But after 1905, after losing Dalny to Japan in the war, the CER had to adapt. Its role shifted. Governor Pavel Unterberger noted its new, much more important role for the Russian Far East itself, rather than just projecting power into Manchuria. The war really sharpened the state's focus on consolidating its own territory as part of the nation.
And this led directly to another huge railway project.
Yes, the Amur Railway, built between 1907 and 1916. It ran entirely within Russian territory, unlike the CER, and was deemed absolutely vital after the war.
Who championed this one?
Fyodor Stolypin. A really key minister at the time. In a powerful speech in 1908, he argued for it, based squarely on strategic concerns and, again, that fear of foreign infiltration.
And he saw the settlers as key.
Absolutely. He had this vision of Russian peasants and workers as direct nation builders. He said something like, "These Russian pioneers will build the road, they'll settle around this road, they will move into the region, and at the same time move Russia there."
Move Russia there. It's so explicit.
It really is. Stolypin even used that powerful two-headed eagle metaphor, the imperial symbol, to reaffirm Russia's ideological belief in the indivisible unity of its European and Asian parts, that Russian Eurasia idea. The Far East wasn't separate. It was integral.
But bringing in even more settlers, especially after Stolypin's reforms ramped up migration, you said 200,000 between 1906 and 1910? That must have created friction.
Huge friction, especially over land. And it definitely intensified tensions around what was unfortunately termed the yellow
culture. Which was essentially about
the perceived challenge posed by Asian migration and settlement in the region. It was a discriminatory and problematic framing, but it was influential.
Who were the main groups involved?
Primarily Chinese laborers and Korean farmers. Chinese seasonal workers have been coming since the 1860s, really, and many Koreans settled more permanently, often adopting Orthodox Christianity, learning Russian.
And their numbers were significant.
They were. Estimates for Chinese laborers alone ranged up to 200,000 or even 250,000 at peak times. They made up a substantial portion of the non-Russian population.
But didn't the region's economy kind of need them?
Ah, that's the massive complexity, yes. Economically, Chinese laborers are absolutely vital. For example, in 1910, they made up something like 82% of all workers in the gold mining industry.
82%.
Yeah. And even Russian peasant settlers often relied on Chinese market gardeners for fresh produce because, frankly, as some Russian agronomists admitted, the Russian peasant often struggled with the specific climate and farming conditions. Korean and Chinese techniques were often better suited.
So economic necessity versus nationalist ideology.
Precisely that tension. Despite this economic interdependence, the yellow peril ideology, pushed by hardline nationalists like the military governor Nikolai Gondaty, led to a series of increasingly harsh anti-Chinese laws.
What kind of laws?
Things like restricting permanent settlement only to those who became naturalized Russian citizens, prohibiting Russians from renting property to foreigners or hiring them for certain jobs, introducing really stringent passport checks at the border.
Pretty severe.
And the most radical measure came in 1914, basically aiming to remove all Asian citizens from Russian towns altogether.
But could they actually enforce all this in such a huge, remote region?
Well, that's where the practicalities of governing really hit home. Often these laws were relaxed or ignored on the ground. Why? Personnel shortages, widespread corruption among officials.
Standard bureaucratic issues.
Right. But the biggest factor derailing these policies was the outbreak of World War I.
The Great War changed everything.
Completely. Suddenly, Chinese labor became, and this is a direct quote, "vital to sustain the war effort." Immediate economic and political necessity simply overrode patriotism and racism.
So even as the state was trying to build this ethnically homogenous Russian nation in the Far East, the realities on the ground and then global events kept forcing compromises.
Exactly. The grand vision of a nationalizing empire constantly bumped up against messy realities and external pressures.
What an incredible deep dive. It really is remarkable thinking about how Tsarist Russia, under Alexander III and then Nicholas II, managed to transform the Far East.
It's a huge shift, isn't it? From this vulnerable periphery, often linked with exile, underdevelopment,
the convict colony idea.
Right. To becoming, or at least moving towards becoming, a much more integrated part of Russian national territory.
And achieved through those three main strategies you walked us through. That massive peasant resettlement.
The truly monumental construction of the Trans-Siberian and Amur railways.
And those complex, often contradictory policies towards the Asian minorities living there.
But as we saw, this process was anything but smooth or straightforward. The essay rightly calls it volatile and unpredictable.
Yeah, marked by those inconsistent policies, incoherent visions, and conflicting administrative rule you mentioned. Lots of internal contradictions.
Definitely. And it's a really sobering reminder that despite all these czarist efforts at integration, the perception of vulnerability lingered. So much so that the later Stalinist regime felt it necessary to deport virtually all Koreans and Chinese from the region in the 1930s.
A tragic later chapter.
Indeed. Yet despite those later events and the earlier inconsistencies, you have to say that the core nation-building strategies used by the imperial state over a century ago were, in the long run, pretty successful.
How so?
Well, the Russian Far East is still an integral part of Russia today. The sheer scale of what they undertook building the world's longest railway, moving millions of peasants, it demonstrates an extraordinary level of state commitment.
Commitment to what, ultimately?
Commitment to unifying the empire's peripheries, to integrating them into what the thinker Peter Struve, rather brilliantly, if oxymoronically, called the nation-state empire.
The nation-state empire. That phrase really captures the paradox, doesn't it? It challenges how we usually separate those two ideas, nation and empire.
It absolutely does. And maybe that raises a final thought for you, our listener, to consider. How might similar entangled processes, nation-building and empire-building working together, have shaped other parts of the world you know?
And what does this specific history of the Russian Far East tell us about how fluid and complex things like national identity and imperial ambition can actually be?
Something to ponder, perhaps.
Definitely something to ponder. Thanks for diving deep with us today.